They said he was here a minute on 2nd March 78.
Yeah, I think, you know, inevitably there was duplication around the world because people were a long way apart, and we used to get enormous reports coming in from radiation lab and British laboratories. But they would tell you quite a lot. In the end, you had to do what was right for the Southwest Pacific, which is where we were involved. And the magnetron work, I remember, at Melbourne University was involved with a pretty big magnetron for 25 centimetres. This airborne height finding that we worked on in the later stages of the war was 25 centimetres, and that was to be used for the Australian forces. And that magnetron had to be built in Australia, designed and built, couldn't get it anywhere else. Similarly, in the common aerial working, we were right at the front of that, and you couldn't get the tubes for that very easily, so one group in the radiophysics division was producing specialist diodes, which are designed specifically to carry the big pulse emissions and then shut off their and then later on the glow discharges, which were produced by Oliphant's brother. He was a glassblower in Adelaide, and he produced those glow discharge tubes. So you did things for yourself that you couldn't get anywhere else.
So you were definitely knowledgeable about what was going on in the other labs. There was no overall authority saying this lab does this lab does that.
No, not that I know of, although I suppose the Radiophysics Advisory Board would have had high-level contacts with overseas places, and from time to time our top people would go on overseas visits. I remember Poising went away. Must have been about 1942 on the microwave developments to get all the background.
And Bowen, you haven't mentioned his name. He was in the...
Well, he went over with the radiation lab with the magnetron with Tissard's mission. And he came to us in 1943. He stopped on at radiation lab to start it. That was the nucleus of the radiation lab getting into the work. He'd been working since 1935 on radar with Watson Watt.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all in the books.
Well, I have talked to him himself.
Yeah, sure. So. I was 43 when he turned up here, and he didn't become chief till after the war. Towards the end of the war, he was an assistant. And there was another man who was assistant on engineering, Taffy was assistant on scientific side. And then the other chap became chief for a short period. And then Taffy, when he left, took over. And then Poising was assistant to him. So we knew Taffy from about 1933 onwards.
See, while we're talking about names, who else later on went into radio astronomy, worked in the lab? I think Mills?
Yes, Mills. Mills was one of the intake after me, like Brian Cooper was, and before us, Bergen and so on. We were sort of second intake. Mills, he didn't go into radio astronomy straight away. After the war, there was a period where the techniques and technology of radar were applied to civil applications, and radio astronomy wasn't known except it's called cosmic noise or solar noise, and it was a scientific subject of small dimensions.
Right.
And we had a whole area of things that looked as though they might be important in peace, and that was just one of them. So Mills worked on acceleration of was it electrons or protons, which with magnetrons, cavities accelerating the particles through to generate X-rays.
Mm-hmm. You know,
perhaps a cheap and economic way of producing X-rays.
But he only stayed with that for a couple of years, I think.
Yes, he did, and he did pretty well at that, I remember. And then radio astronomy, of course, was growing.
Well, we're getting a little bit ahead of ourselves. Let's talk about now the end of the war and the decisions that were made at that time.
Well, yes, the lab by the end of the war was pretty big. I've forgotten the numbers in it, but it's bigger than it was now. You know, might have been another 100 or so people. Mm-hmm. They'd been continually flooding in. They kept pulling people back that had gone through Sydney University years before me in various roles and capacities. But at the end of the war, having decided... Poising and Bowen between them, what were the likely fields to get into. No more secret work, you see, was to be done. A lot of the people went off to other work. They weren't interested in staying in research. They went back to industry, many of them. But a certain number of people were asked if they'd like to stay on. I was one of them, Bernie Mills would have been another. Frank Kerr was another. Frank and I worked together. Quite
well,
closely.
In fact, I was talking with Don Yapsley.
Don Yapsley was another one. There was Ron Bracewell.
Fittington,
of course. Pulley, Dr. Pulley, went into atomic energy, went into the Atomic Energy Commission. Oh, there must be a whole lot that I can't immediately recall. Ruby Payne-Scott. Lahaney, I'm not sure when he joined us, but he certainly was part of the radio physics
lab. McCready?
McCready, certainly, right. And there was a chap called Dobby. He's died since. Pybus. I can probably refresh myself on these names before you go, you know.
Well, I can,
some old list.
I can try to find a roster for 1945.
Have you seen the history of the radio physics lab and the volume that was written?
Working my way through it now.
It's got appendices, I think, of people in the staff builder.
Right.
But if you wanted, you know, if you picked any names out of that and wanted me to search my memory as to what they were doing and how they went over. I remember towards the end of the war, I hadn't been in receivers, working in receivers very much. Lindsay McCready and Ruby Payne-Scott had. But they were getting more and more sensitive. And the whole theory of the noise level and the thermodynamic theory of it and its relationship through the antenna to space, if it were in an enclosure at 300 degrees, you know, what was the noise level taking on? Taking it out of the purely circuit sort of approach that had been worked up by Nyquist and others. You are now into the thermodynamics of an antenna immersed in an enclosure. And they were getting more sensitive, and it obviously occurred to them that radiation from objects might be possible to be seen. And there was one room at the Radio Physics in the University which had a window. I remember Ruby had a small parabola poking out the window at certain objects in the sky to see how the noise level varied.
This is during the war, no?
During the war, it was 44 even, I think, 45, and there are a couple of reports. Some of this, by the way, I'm not sure whether you've got it, there's a biography of Pawsey written by Lovell. Have you seen that one?
After he died? Don Yapsley just gave me a copy.
Yes, I've got a copy of that too, and I read a section of that, and in looking up the work, you'll find references there to various papers of that time. I had to go through what we had.
Mm-hmm.
And
so are you saying now that Ruby Payne-Scott actually wrote up some sort of quantitative results on what she was to detect?
There's a report with a name on it of that experiment, as I remember.
I see.
Should be in that.
I haven't heard about that.
That bibliography. Not very much, mind you, and why they didn't look at the sun, I don't know, but...
anything is more than I knew about.
Yeah. I went through the reports pretty carefully in trying to write that. I wanted to get a full assessment of his scientific background at that time, and looked at all sorts of things he'd been interested in, like lightning flashes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, apart from the war work, he was probing around with his mind.
Mm.
And I think that's probably the best source of what I was able to find.
Okay.
So you could see the logical development there, and of course with the wartime reports of Hay and so on, you were immediately onto those like a flash.
And Jansky and Reber, work were known.
That's right. And as soon as the war ended and it was decided to take as one of the subjects, cosmic noise and solar noise, he got his hands on some of the old radars sets, the ones at Dover Heights and the ones you mentioned yesterday were part of that program. Some of the old 36 element arrays that were design, and he built it up from there. I was sent off to the radiation lab while the war was still on, so I missed a period there. We started to get interested in possibilities of millimeter waves and K-band particularly, and I spent not all the time at radiation lab, split about 6 months between radiation lab and the Bell Telephone Laboratories, Naval Research Lab.
Was this at the end of the war you're talking about?
No, it was after the Germans surrender, but before the Japanese.
Okay, 1945, yeah.
Yes, it's about May 1945 I went away. I was in New York when the Japanese gave in.
Mm-hmm.
I was in Ottawa in the High Commissioner's offices. It happened when he told us about the atom bomb. asked us if we knew anything about it. I was with George Munro, I think. He's a radio research world personality from the 1930s. He was running the Washington liaison office at that time.
See.
That's how we learned about it. So I came back after August sometime.
Tell me now, in the radiation lab, did you talk with Dickey's group and Dickey himself?
I don't remember talking to Dickey. I was concentrating on the millimeter or centimetric components, and it was an enormous place. There was a fundamental group, Purcell, I think, was running it at the time, and finding out as much as I could of what the techniques were doing. Getting pretty loaded up with that end of the spectrum. For some reason or other, I didn't. I probably sent reports back, maybe Dickie's report. I certainly had a copy of his report when I was back here. That one you shared that photograph from yesterday, that building. Mm-hmm. That was a sort of starting point for 1.275 centimeter work. We built a Dickey system using that report, what was in it as a basis for designing the thing.
No, I've never seen the original report. I got that from the Rad Lab series of books.
I see.
It's published in there, so I'd like to see that original report.
They were grey covered reports, and I hope we've still got it. It was very fundamental, and it had an appendix on the noise levels, which would be achievable.
It's a radiation lab report.
Yeah. They're grey covered with a little window in the middle of the cover, which showed you the title underneath.
Might be some hope the library has that still.
Yes. We kept a lot of reports. Arthur Higgs had the job of going through them because the armed services wanted to hang on to certain kinds. So there was a division made, and they went off with a whole lot, and we kept a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You'd have the reference number to that report from the Radiation Lab series, I think. If you asked Marjorie about it, she might be able to... She'd tell you whether we got it anyway.
Right. Will do.
But that was the starting point. We didn't actually... When I came back, I was a bit busy for a while. Taffy had other ideas for millimeter waves and so on.
Did he want to do astronomical observations with millimeter waves? Or?
No, he that was just one of the topics that might be interesting to do. He had all sorts of other things. The one... He was particularly interested in navigation in the war. He did, before he went to America, he'd done a lot of night fighter development with Hanby Brown. Hanby Brown and Taffy flew together for thousands of hours. And... He was very air-minded. He liked radio and he liked aircraft. Same as Henry. Henry was fascinated by aircraft and radio. His father had all sorts of... he was brought up in an atmosphere of radio. He had coherers.
Really?
And when he was a young boy, his father had these things and was experimenting with them. So Henry was induced into the subject. But his other love was flying. And it happened that they flew together. So he was very keen on aircraft and... their problems of navigation. So one of the things after the war was the group was called Radio Navigation and worked on a whole variety of things, but one of them was the measurement of distance to a beacon on the ground, putting the result on a meter. And we produced a distance measuring equipment. Brian Cooper was the key man in that. And,
this is 1945?
It would have been about 45, 46, and for about 5 years it went on. And it gradually was handed over to industry. Amalgamated Wireless has been marketing them ever since. They're on all the Australian airliners. It works in the 200 megahertz band.
Mm-hmm.
It was in operation before the international one, which was pushed hard by the United States. There's a big argument on the whole organisation of civil aviation. Britain had all sorts of systems coming out of radar, mainly hyperbolic. Your country pushed the R-theta system with ranging and bearing from omnidirectional range. That was a big bust-up. Business.
It appears these battles still go on.
yes, it's part of
the
human life.
Articles you have posted down in the hallway there.
Yes, oh, they do, no doubt about it. We happen to be on the other side this time. But Bergman and Taffy were very much involved in that early provisional International Civil Aviation Conference. And
so were you working on navigation systems
I wasn't
at the same
that time?
No.
We started off to say what the fields of work were and
oh, I see.
What
okay.
Taffy was interested in. He was interested in navigation of aircraft. And the distance measuring equipment was one, and then we had a multiple track range which went with it and produced hyperbolic tracks. The stations were put fairly close together, so the hyperbole became radial tracks very quickly in straight lines, except along the extended baseline where you had a sort of dead zone. But it made a sort of R-theta system over a very wide coverage. Maston Beard worked on. And there were various other devices. Navigation of ships in the harbour at 3 centimetres.
Uh-huh. Rain physics probably also possibly.
Rain physics was another topic he got onto, and that was a long time. He's still in it, you know. It was his, one of his prime interest, he ran that. Bergman ran the radio navigation group at the time, Brian Cooper, and there were the linear accelerators, and then there was an electronic computer produced about 1948, 49 with Maston Beard and Trevor Piercy. That worked well. It was before solid state and a great room full of valves. That was used to Melbourne University for quite a while, and found its way into a museum down there now. And there was a vacuum physics lab started up. That's how Mills did his work with magnetrons, and solid state work was started after the Bell Lab work came along. You've got to understand that we had an obligation to industry, you see. That's what CSIRO is about. And all of these projects were aimed with those sort of things in mind. And getting into the solid state work was perhaps not so much a matter of research, because there's so much being done overseas, but getting the technology into Australia. So Taffy's idea was to start up a laboratory here, you know, specialising in that sort of thing. And one of its aims was its application of solid state to the distance measuring equipment and other navigational aids. And in fact, the distance measuring equipment was transistorised eventually.
I see.
But the other function was to build up enough know-how to tell industry all about it. And there were a series of quite long seminars held, lectures given to industry, and they were very successful. That sort of got them rolling a bit. They could talk to people who had actually been working in the field, you see. So he had a broad range of interests in those last 1950s.
So most of these activities actually were applied, sort of
they
things.
Were applied, working on the accumulated bank-up of technology from the wartime. And they worked their way through, I suppose by 1955, that's 10 years, they'd been pretty well exploited. And radio navigation, which I got into towards the end, Bergman went off somewhere. I'm jumping ahead a bit here. I got into with the millimetre waves. I never quite got to millimetre waves, I've only just got to them, but I was into low centimetric waves for a while. But in 1948 it would have been radio astronomy or radio noise work had been growing in importance and people were being sucked into it. And I was asked I'd like to work in that, and I was with Jack Pittington. That was the start of that. That went on for, seems a short time now, but...
Well, your last publication was in 52.
Yes, I think it was 51. And there was a need to continue the radio navigation work. I think I had an offer of a job outside, too, at that time in industry, and Taffy made a counter-offer. And I accepted it. I think it was the wrong thing at the time, because radio navigation was on the decline, and the projects were getting pretty hard. We had a long-range navigation system working up to Townsville, which is about 1,000 miles away via the ionosphere. Frank Gardner was working on that. The idea of perhaps being able to navigate over the horizon, like this scatter radar now, but it was actually a beacon. And Frank got quite a bit of ionospheric knowledge out of it, and got some benefit from it. But it was being played out, and it happened that towards the end, the money for a big telescope was coming along, so that's when I transferred, and that was in 55. So I had from 48 to 51.
Three-year period.
Yeah, it seemed longer than that, but it wasn't very long, with Pittington.
Well, why don't we start talking about the radio-astronomical things you did. The first project, it appears, was to look at the moon.
Well, the first thing, coming back to Dickey and what I'd done at Radiation Lab, where did we start? And Pawsey, who laid down the law on these things in those days, he had the whole thing in his grip, you know, he knew where everyone was working and why they should be working there. There were a pretty big team already working at meter wavelengths, where a lot of interesting things are happening. Bolton, Stanley,
and
so on. Plenty of bursts from Sun if you wanted to work on the Sun and so on. So we were allocated the other end of the spectrum, down as far as we could get. And we picked 1.25 because of Dickey's equipment, and we had this grey-covered report, and I don't know how long it took, but we got one together pretty smartly. Made the rotating switch that was needed to do the chopping, synchronous detection, and so on. And put it up on the roof, and I'll show you a photograph of that. I was only about a year ago came across this. I've been unable to find a photograph of it. That's the thing we had.
Oh, yes.
This is the old National Standards building in at the university. That's the tower near City Road there. And we had a place we called the Eagle's Nest, which was a a wooden room that had been built on the top of a high point of the building, which had a flat roof, and they built a room. And then we put this thing on the roof of that room, and the room underneath, you come down through a ladder and a trapdoor, was the laboratory of the equipment. So this is sitting on that roof of the Eagle's Nest.
Is there an aircon between the...
That was a loudspeaker intercom. We could talk into it or hear out of it. Built that for the purpose. And this was a searchlight mirror, 48 inches in diameter, with a very good optical surface. It was metal. Metal thing polished up with some sort of good surface put under it for searchlight purposes, but made a very good 1 centimeter mirror. We measured it up with a parabolic shape, and it was very good indeed.
And here's your guiding optical telescope?
Yeah, we built that was a projection thing. We made a screen that it could project an image under it, as well as having, we had sundry other, there's another one, so a couple of them there to look through with a filter on. This one we could see the disk of the sun, nice big disk, fairly long focal length.
Did you take drifters, or did you try to track?
Oh, we did all sorts of things with it. We tracked the moon, but we were working on the sun as well. The moon we would sight through these things without the filter, of course. And this was the chopper, you know, the chopper and preamplifier were in there, and all the rest of the gear was down below. And we had this behind, first of all, and had enormous trouble. There was a long waveguide from the output here, running up along one of these legs to there, and get rid of the drifts. The Dickey system was very good for getting rid of the drifts behind the chopper, you see. The Bolton and company were stabilising their power supplies with enormous effort. Because Dickey made a lot of this unnecessary, although we stabilised ours too, we didn't have to fuss too much about them. But there are always still various sources of drift, and we spent a lot of time trying to track these things down. You get local oscillator drifts, and you could get various reflections from an impedance mismatch here, and it'd come back again and be reflected into the system again and give you drifts. In the end, Jack Piddington, I got getting a bit depressed one day, and he said, well, take it off, and we'll put it right in the front. It seemed a shocking thing to do. I remember I was horrified at the time. It was the right move to make, and we just had a little short stubby thing, and that did it straight away. It stabilised it.
The only disadvantage of this is blocking some of the aperture.
Yes, I just didn't like that.
And there's no access. I mean, with a larger dish, there's an access problem when you do that.
Yes, no, it's just the blockage. It was a fairly small aperture.
Let me just ask why Bolton and others did not use the Dickey system.
I think they just got under their own way, stabilizing power supplies and being very careful about filaments of valves and so on. Once having started, they just hung under it. I think that's all it was. I mean, started, the inertia just kept them going that way.
So what got you particularly interested in the moon?
Well, we looked at everything, of course. Having got it stable enough, we had to phase lock I built a phase locking system for the local oscillator, locked it to a cavity, and then trying to get rid of all the drift. Having done that, Dickey had looked at the moon.
Right.
That was the point. He'd made one measurement, I think, at full moon or new moon, I've forgotten. Just the one, gone off and read this report and gone off. So we thought, well, we'll look at the moon and see whether he got the right number or not. And with this, of course, we had the opportunity to look at it not just one night, but to keep going. That seemed a sensible thing to do, to see whether... Well, I suppose the thought was, what'll happen with the moon waxing and waning, new moon, full moon, what about that? And we thought, well, it'll probably just follow the illumination curve. And it didn't, you see. It was a strange thing. That got us excited straight away. It had this phase lag for 3 days and...
45-degree...
Yeah, well, it was just a time lag at the start, just those number of days behind. And in following this through, we went on for many months, you see, finally. But why was this happening? And I remember Jack Piddington one day saying, I think I've got it. It's the thermal inertia of the whole system in the cafeteria one day. And we can work it out. There was a book by Jager, a classic book on...
You referenced that book in your paper.
Homogeneous bodies, I think. He was a very good applied mathematician.
Conduction of heat in solids.
Yes.
By Karslaw and Jager.
Karslaw was professor of mathematics at Sydney University, and Jager was a very, very good applied
mathematician. So this result was quite unexpected. It wasn't a matter that you read up on the theory of the moon and...
just ran into it.
You didn't look into the infrared work that had been done on the moon either?
Looked at Pettit and Savart, I think it was,
on
measurement of temperatures, which it was just interesting to read what people had done.
But you did that only after you made your measurements.
So it was a matter of explaining it, and I think I was able to... I worked this theory out first. Jack dropped the idea, and I worked out the what should be obtained using Jager's thermal equations. It's a matter of the waves running down into the moon's surface. There's a cyclic heating of the moon's surface. And I went into the sort of distribution of this radiation across the moon as a function of how it was looking at the sun, and then analysed this into components. And then from Jager's stuff on the way, a harmonic variation of temperature of the surface would set up thermal waves going down. This gave me the distribution of temperature down through the moon's surface. And then we had the emissivity laws of radiation for microwaves. Just marry those two together and you're able to come up with an equation which gave a delay which we hoped would fit. And
Well, as I mentioned to you before, this is one of my favourite papers, so to speak, in the history of radio astronomy, in that you made deductions which were only fully proved, shall we say, 30 years later when Apollo...
Yes, about the
20
dust.
Years later.
About the dust.
a nice little layer of dust, and that turned out to be right on the money. Let me ask you a couple specific questions about this paper. At one point you say, the complete equipment, the calibrating procedure, and the observational techniques found necessary to make effective use of the apparatus in radio astronomy will be described more fully elsewhere. I don't think that ever got done.
See, Jack was a scientist, and the equipment was a means to an end. I would have liked to have written up the thing fully myself, but it was since I'd had to sweat over it to make it work with Jim Heineman. But he'd no sooner get one paper out, and he'd have a new idea. He's always had new ideas for papers, so it never got written, I'm afraid. That was about the extent of it.
How about, here's another statement where you say, at these frequencies, cosmic noise is negligible, and if the aerial beam is not moved during a measurement, the received atmospheric radiation is constant. Were you not bothered by clouds at all?
Yeah, terribly.
But why didn't you didn't mention them?
Didn't mention them there, no. I didn't appreciate it for a while. The atmosphere was important, of course, that's what Dickie was measuring. Every observation we made, we had to do this vertical tip down and get the variation for that particular day, and we'd do that every day for into the moon. The clouds, though, during this business when we couldn't get it stable...
Oh, here you do say, some of these results were discarded because of unfavorable conditions due to cloud or strong winds.
Right, well...
You didn't mention that later.
I became aware of the cloud effects, because you go up there and you see this thing wandering all over the place, and after a while it did become evident that it was clouds partly, it wasn't everything, but clouds partly. Then we, when we put it around the front here and it got rid of a lot of those effects, we just had to keep clear of clouds. I guess we weren't too aware of the cosmic side of it too in that early work.
Yeah, you never mentioned an upper limit or anything like that for the noise in the background.
No.
You undoubtedly could have derived one. But
we could have, yes.
Do you have any idea what your sensitivity was? I suppose that could be deduced
that
from this paper
in there.
Also.
Yeah. It was down with Dickie. Well, there is often a factor of two in these things, which is hard to beat, but...
well, let's see now. It's going
we had a pretty good noise figure. In the
assuming that you took many measurements of the background, and then you took sort of the lower envelope of those measurements, it would just be a matter then of what your RMS noise is in a single measurement.
Well, the RMS noise will be there.
You say here 1.2 kelvins.
Is sounds the about
square.
Right. We had a pretty wide bandwidth. I think it was about 10 megahertz, and we could have time constants up to perhaps 10 seconds.
So
switchable.
So presumably you could have gotten down to say that there's nothing more than 10 degrees in the background or something like that.
Yeah, yes.
Although it's trickier to do it against an absolute, I mean...
Yes, it is.
To say the least.
The calibration was done with a heated layered... Wait, I think Dickie had done that too. He made an absorbing layered and could heat it up through perhaps 50 degrees thermal layered.
But how was the zero level determined? In fact, now here looking at your curve... we can see that the minimum aerial temperature that you have is 32 kelvins.
If they're looking at the sky.
But now, how
do you calibrate the temperature scale? In other
right,
words?
Right. Well, how did you do that?
Well, I guess we had two points, didn't we? We could have a load at a measured temperature, thermal ambient temperature. Then we'd make a differential change in it, which would give us a slope.
And with the zero level, though.
Yeah. And did we have an absolute temperature from somewhere? Well, we must have just had an ambient temperature. That would have been measured in a thermometer, I suppose. We didn't ever have any cold points. No thermos flask of anything. Not that I remember.
No liquid nitrogen or anything.
We got the slope, and I guess we would have just made a temperature measurement. We may have had thermocouples. Yeah, there was a thermocouple embedded in the thing, calibrated by the National Standards Lab. And the rise in temperature would have been very carefully measured. And the absolute, one of the points absolutely. So that we took, if I remember rightly, would have been our temperature scale.
Also, you say the density and specific heat of the solid material of the moon's crust will probably not differ essentially from those from basalt, which was not a bad...
Well, that was a thought. Jagger was very interested in that because he'd been writing papers on the thermal properties of the moon.
The two-layer model, you say, was just a brainstorm that came to give this phase
line. Well, Jack, I think, produced the two-layer model. I'd happen to get the mathematics out before he did on the one-layer, and he was a sort of engineer's approach, and I knew how to get it, and I did it, but he refined it a bit after that, mm-hmm. expressed it in physicist terms, and subsequently suggested the two-layer model.
And
I got pushed around by various people subsequently.
As I was saying, you turned out to only have a slightly deeper layer than what the Apollo people eventually found.
Yes.
Well, let's move on to... you just said that you looked at many different objects, but I don't believe you published any negative results on
K-band. We did sometimes, but we did... 1 centimeter was a pretty hard place to start with. Not much happened, for example, on the sun. It was a very dead sort of... You know, we got the temperature of the sun, the base level temperature.
Mm-hmm.
Some sunspot... No, we couldn't get any sunspot activity.
But did you think of taking a drift curve on the Orion Nebula or anything like this?
Oh, I think we did. But didn't get anything. And it didn't publish a limit, but we did at higher wavelengths. I suppose what we did, you see, we worked up gradually towards the people who were working in meter wavelengths. The whole series, 3.18 centimeters, 10 centimeters, and 25 was the last one I did. And at each wavelength, we would look at objects, and in some of them, 10 centimeter ones, I think you found there might be limits set. But at 25, we certainly were getting things, especially Crab Nebula.
Right, we'll be coming to that shortly.
But it was a matter of, it was a bit negative in a way. Disappointing.
Well, but sometimes these upper limits are interesting.
Yes.
A bit of a shame you didn't mention some of them.
Can I shift that?
Yeah, sure.
Just wanted to refer to where you've seen these, no doubt. I guess they cover the work at the time.
Right. That's where we're coming to here.
Yes. See, that was 10 centimeters. And that was number 3, and this was the early one. I think you'll find that in here... Oh, it's entirely solar. Maybe it's the 25 solar too. Here we are. I guess there are some upper limits in here at 3,000.
Which paper is this now?
That
this
one?
Is Piddington and Minnett, what year?
51.
Let's see, there was nothing mentioned in the abstract anyway, but maybe
some secrets. 3,000 megacentimeters. These are techniques. So we'll go over the page. Here we are, it's just this paragraph.
And then you hear you're talking about what was later known as Sagittarius A.
Yeah. About 12-10, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Now, it doesn't look like there was a... Here's the crab.
Yeah, Taurus A. On several occasions, attempts were made to observe and measure radiation from Taurus A at 3,000. And there's an upper limit to the flux density.
And then you discuss what that upper limit... Oh, here we go, radiation from other sources. and you talk about Cygnus A and Cygnus X.
No attempt was made at 3,000 to observe Centaurus A, and the other two could not be seen, Virgo A and Hercules A.
So their flux densities must be less than about 2,000 Janskys, as we would now say with your...
I think you'll find spotted through here statements like that about 3,000. It's basically 1,200
but
where they
kept
going. Not at K-band, not at 3 centimetres. 3 centimetre work was the solar experimental labour. There's an eclipse.
Yeah, okay, let's move on to that. That was published in 1950, where, well, first of all, the paper was mainly about monitoring the sun over 3 months.
Yes.
And you came up with, what were the main results of that study, would you say?
Well, there was the white sun base level. And we looked at the effective sunspots. This was the standard technique at the time, the sort of statistical correlation technique, the way the temperature varied with sunspot area. I think we got some observations of bursts, and then it had the eclipse. I've forgotten about the bursts, what happened?
You knew about the work of Covington.
Yes, we knew. Covington was very much specialized on the sun. There were small burst effects, I think. I don't think there was anything in 1 centimeter, it's just a matter of getting the measurement of 3.
Now, what about this 1948 eclipse that you looked at?
There are a series of 3 centimeter bursts, you say, on February 18th. It was not accompanied by any measurable disturbance of wavelengths greater than 10 centimeters. And then there was this eclipse. This was done in Victoria, Cairnsdale.
Why did you go there? Because it was a greater...
Well, that was the place to... Yes, that was a good... gave the best duration of the eclipse. Then we had a trailer, and Jim Hyman took it down, and I went down for the eclipse. I didn't actually see it. My mother died the day before, I think. Came back. And there are all the usual things that can happen to you during the eclipse that you get sorted out. I didn't think it was particularly a wonderful result, but we got what we could out of it. I guess they were the main results at 3 centimeters.
And you, of course, you measured a mean brightness temperature for the sun.
Yes. Yeah, we did that on every wavelength.
Well, the next paper is a sort of an overall analysis paper that you and Pittington did in 51.
Is that the thermal emission?
Where you broke the solar emission up into 3 components.
Yes.
Steady component B, slowly varying component S, and the rapid fluctuations X.
That's this one, I think.
And this, I gather, was an attempt to try to make a coherent picture out of the whole microwave.
Yeah, we tried to
picture.
Get a model for the whole thing, the slowly varying component and the base level. And then there's a theoretical model for this, wasn't there?
Yeah, on this, and a model hot region.
Got into electromagneto-ionic theory there for these diagrams.
So you and Pittington were working on all aspects of this paper together?
This was... I hadn't had anything to do with magneto-ionic theory before. He had, because of the ionosphere, but I got into it at that point, and it's a fairly subtle sort of theory. There are some discontinuities, singularities in the thing, and I devised this... this way of making these clear, which Pawsey thought was a great thing. I think he put this in his book at the time.
your figure 6
these,
in the paper.
You got these
yeah.
Various modes of propagation and whether the stuff can get out or not. And these pictures proved to be a nice way,
a way of presenting,
seeing what was going on very clearly and seeing the different levels from which the radiation could come. Having got that all clear in my mind, I then went on and this was under Jack's general direction, but I did all the work on it. And produced this model, which was an attempt to explain. These are the hot spots around the sunspot. And I think there was some French work at the time.
By Denise?
Yeah, Denise. I think we thought we were making a bit of an advance on what he'd done. A couple of papers there by Denise. It was a bit more comprehensive, probably, the model than what they'd been considering. I must say I'm pretty rusty on the detail of all this now at this distance and I've been able to refresh my mind, but that's the general picture I had. I think we thought this model was something quite worthwhile at the time.
How did this differ in approach from, say, what Smerd was working on at this time?
I can't answer that. I wasn't away, and I don't remember that we ever got together on anything of that sort, or whether there is any way overlapping us.
Well, he, of course, was worrying about ray trajectories
yes.
in the atmosphere and
yes, but in a pretty detailed way, I think. I think we were sufficiently, you know, our thoughts were concentrated sufficiently differently. He was probably going into ray tracing quite rigorously, and we just dived in and tried to make a model that simply fitted around a hotspot. You know, it's a special sort of case,
mm-hmm.
trying to explain the way in which the radiation component, this slowly varying component, ought to vary with sunspot number. And we just went ahead on our own. I suppose Jack was the principal theoretician in the work, of course, and he may be able to fill in on this. If there was any talking with Steve, then he would have gone and done it himself, I think.
I find that sort of interesting, though, that here you would have you two and then Smir both very interested in understanding solar radiation, and yet you're operating quite independently, it seems, even though you're in the same lab.
I can't recollect Steve's part at that time. Pretty early on, you see.
But I think
Steve didn't get on with Taffy, and it's not relevant. But,
Let's see, this was published in 51, so you probably submitted it in 50, but I think Smird's earliest models were published in 1950 or so. Also.
He was straight, Steve was a straight theoretician in those days. I don't think Paul had got going, you know, with the
Taffy.
Yeah,
I think that's
Paul
right.
Paul was working somewhere else. Steve was a theoretician, didn't get on with Taffy, and he was working probably on a very rigorous formulation.
Mm-hmm.
We couldn't wait for this, but I imagine Jack was well aware of everything that was going on
mm-hmm.
while we were building all this equipment and making it work. He'd be theorising, talking to people, and quite often I wouldn't know everything he'd done. We'd come together just every so often and compare notes, so he might be able to answer that particular very much better. But
okay,
I certainly had no contact with Steve at all.
I've been getting a picture as I talked to many people around the lab that the organizational setup was many small groups which were often not even physically in the same place, out at field sites, and Bosley would visit them and try to coordinate things, and he did.
It was a horizontal structure.
Right.
But Bosley was in direct linkage with everyone. And there were little isolated groups. He'd try and make sure they didn't clash. And he stopped us working at times when Jack had some idea and we'd start in a new direction and we'd be told to stop.
Can you think of any particular example of
I remember I got started on interferometry. We were going to do. There was one small experiment we'd done with the 1 centimeter thing instead of that dish. I'd got hold of 2 18-inch mirrors. There are a lot of those around from radar. Well, they're X-band anyway. They're about right for 1 centimeter. And we had 2 of these mounted on a boom on that same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And we were doing some interference on sun. But later on, Jack had thought to extend the microwave work into a proper interferometer on the ground, and there was another group that already was working on interferometry. I think Chris was around at that time, Ruby Payne-Scott. Chris eventually got onto his grating idea.
Mm-hmm.
I remember I'd toyed with all sorts of thoughts about optical equivalents. Pretty obvious, you know, diffraction grating had a similar thing in that you could get a series of isolated beams. I thought about the Fabry-Perot interferometry and talked to Posey about it. He discussed whether it was in resolution that it had these good properties or whether it was going to be an antenna with a proper beam or not and so on. So
that's interesting. Has anyone ever worked up a radio analogue to a Fabry-Perot?
I think there has been. I've seen the thing come up subsequently.
Huh, I've never
thought
of that.
He had a little bit of doubt about it. But I'd been interested in optics. I guess it was a sort of fascination that these things had their equivalents of radio.
Mm-hmm.
I remember talking to Ruby about that. The diffraction grating possibility in Fabry-Perot.
Anyway, when you began wandering in that direction.
Yes, well, Posey said, well, there are other people there already and they got a prior claim.
Mm-hmm.
So I was stopped. He found me working. That's how he got to it, and he went and sat on Jack there. And the other thing was that the aerials we'd been using, the antennas, were gradually getting bigger. We'd started with the 4-foot mirror, and the 10-centimeter work was an available paraboloid out at Potts Hill. And then we'd used for 25 centimetres, one Frank Kerr had used a square sort of aperture thing. There's a photograph in one of those papers. So they're getting bigger. And we were starting to think of a radio telescope of fairly decent size for centimetre experiments.
Mm-hmm.